Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the climate wars, the scenarios we are facing, and our options as a humanity. Our options as a humanity may be dwindling in the face of climate change, says our next guest. The coming changes may completely alter the world as we know it, with collapsed ecosystems, mass immigration of climate refugees, and more devastating wars over basic necessities such as food and water. Gwen Dyer is a journalist, columnist, author, broadcaster, and lecturer on international affairs for more than 20 years. He's the author of numerous books, including War Future, Tents and the Mess They Made, as well as his most recent book, Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats. First of all, let's start with what you say may be actually better off. You're saying Scandinavia is a little better off in some ways. Russia might be, Canada might be, Britain might be. They're the winners potentially, but the losers are the South, China. Why?
Well, the closer you are to the equator, the more trouble you're in a warming world. Essentially, the trouble is food. The major impact of warming on human populations is going to be that it cuts into the food supply quite seriously. But that doesn't happen equally all over the planet. The further away you are from the equator, until you get right up in the high north where they don't grow food anyway, but the further away you are from the equator, the less pronounced the warming and the less the impact on food production. So even most of the United States can expect to go on producing food in much the way it does now, though not the southern bits, because the southern bits of the U.S. are actually in the subtropics. People don't realize that, but that's what they are. And the subtropics get hit very hard by this. Essentially, they dry out. They're already very dry, but they suffer a great loss of rainfall. And, you know, basically, without rain, you can't grow crops. So we're looking at places like southwestern U.S., Mexico, Central America, both sides of the Mediterranean, the north side, you know, Spain and Italy and so on, as well as the south, right across the Middle East, Turkey, around places like that. Same story in the southern hemisphere. Most of Australia's in the subtropics, except the very southern fringe of it. Southern Africa, these are places that dry out and can no longer produce a lot of food, which, of course, is kind of non-negotiable. You either eat or die. And so your first impact is on populations that simply can't feed themselves anymore. The further away you are from the equator, the less you are hit by that sort of thing. If you live, say north of the Great Lakes in North America, or even on the south side of the Great Lakes, you're far enough away that you're probably okay until we hit, 2 or 3 degrees of higher average global temperature, which is a good 20 or 30 years away. So it's very much positional. It depends on where you are, how bad this hurts. Major problem that the soldiers see, and I've talked to a lot of soldiers about this, the soldiers see this as a process that's going to produce a lot of refugees. Refugees who are trying to get out of where they are, like Mexico, and up to somewhere where there's still food, or at least jobs that you can buy food with, like the United States. Same coming out of North Africa and the Middle East into Europe, coming out of China up into Russia, coming down from the Philippines and Indonesia into Australia, things like that. And, of course, borders being closed against them. And the dirty little secret is you can only really close a border if you're willing to kill people who try to cross it. So, you know, the world gets a lot uglier. Failed states, governments that can't feed their own people, do not survive on the whole. What's the use of them if they can't even do that basic? That's job one. So failed states, which are pretty ugly things if you think about Somalia times 20, and in some cases wars. Wars between countries especially that have to share the same river system. Because when the going gets rough and there isn't enough rain to go around, the country that's upstream on the river is severely tempted to just hang on to the water and feed its own people and let the downstream country go hang. Downstream country has no recourse except war. So Nile River, Tigris and Euphrates, the Ganges, the Indus River, Mekong, all those rivers are places that wars could happen between the upstream and the downstream states when things get bad, because they probably will. And over the next 10 or 20 years, we can determine the outcome to the extent that it can either be very, very bad or only bad in terms of what the next generation's got to go through, but some of this stuff is going to happen. It's a bit too late to have no bad consequences.
It seems that it also is not necessarily going to follow a very particular pattern. For example, Russia was faced with huge droughts and wildfires, as was Australia, and these are very different parts of the world.
When you have a warming world, what you've got is a more energetic climate. Okay, there's more energy in the system, which means more extremes both of heat and of cold, which is why you get extreme winters as well as extreme summers nowadays. And it's also highly unpredictable as weather. I mean, you can say about climate or about the average global temperature, it's going up by 2 degrees in the next 30 years, let's say. But you can't say what the weather's going to be next week. And in fact, it's harder now to say what the weather will be next week than before, because extreme events in both directions are quite possible. And just to add a further degree of complication, you cannot actually assume that warming will take a gradual, predictable, incremental path. You know, we'll get 1/10 of a degree of warming every 2 years, and, you know, and then in 30 years we'll have a big problem. It can lurch. Which means that you could suddenly it's half a degree warmer all over the planet, which, although it doesn't sound like much, is actually a lot. It would hit crops very hard. I mean, one of the scientists, a guy called John Holdren, who's now the chief scientific advisor to Mr. Obama, said to me a couple of years ago, when you're talking about global temperature, you ought to think about it not like, is this a nice day or a slightly nicer day? You ought to think about it like the temperature of the human body, you know? And 98.6 is fine, and 100 isn't a lot more than 98.6, but you got a fever. It could get quite ugly all of a sudden. This is by no means guaranteed, but you can't discount the possibility, which is, by the way, I think, why the energy secretary, Stephen Chu, came out with this extraordinary idea. He said, look, we know this stuff can lurch, and it's entirely possible that we would suddenly be faced worldwide with a sudden rise of a degree. And I'm talking a degree Celsius, so, you know, a degree and a half or more than 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit in average global temperature, and crops would start to fail all over the world, and there'd be mass famines, and bad things would happen to good people. So what could we do to get the warming down by a degree in a hurry? And he said, well, we've done the numbers. In fact, I know the guy who crunched the numbers. He's called Dennis Bushnell. He's the chief scientist at NASA's Langley facility. And if you just painted all the roads and roofs in the world white, you could lower average global temperature by 1 degree Celsius, because it would reflect enough sunlight to lower the temperature at the surface. We have a lot of roads. That's the sort of thing you want to have in your back pocket in case suddenly the system really surprised, paying attention to as well.
You mentioned early in the book that you thought that the collective efforts of individuals really would barely dent the problem.
Well, if you mean by our collective efforts, light bulbs and driving less, yeah, I'm afraid so. It's not that it's useless, it just isn't the solution. It's a way of winning time in order to get to the solution, but the solution is stop burning fossil fuels, and there's no other solution. Saving energy, as long as your energy is still being generated by fossil fuels, simply postpones the evil day when you put so much of this stuff in the atmosphere you get into runaway warming. And that evil day is generally defined as when we hit about 2 degrees of warming, average global temperature, because at that point we lose control. Natural sources of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases kick in. The permafrost starts to melt and releases enormous amounts of this stuff. You can't turn the permafrost off. You can stop burning fossil fuels yourself, but if you get to the point where the permafrost starts emitting, you finish. You can't refreeze that. Same with the oceans. You warm the oceans and they go. Warmer water can contain less dissolved gas. They've got a lot of carbon dioxide in them, and if you make them warmer, they're going to give some of it back to the atmosphere. It's like, you know, warm beer goes flat, so do warm oceans. Just conserving energies, provided that you're still basically providing your energy with fossil fuels, only postpones the evil day.
You've talked about some of the solutions that are being explored now. Worst case scenarios, we look at geoengineering types of things, although what we're doing now is already a form of geoengineering. Why don't you walk us through what seems to be feasible?
Your solution in the long run is stop burning fossil fuels. But the problem is that it's really hard to turn this civilization on a dime. It's like a supertanker. You can't do a tight turn at the corner. It takes a long time to turn the damn thing around. Are we going to run out of space? Are we going to hit that 2 degrees and unleash runaway warming before we actually get our emissions under control? And most of the people I know think the answer is yes. If you look at the way the politics goes, the United States doesn't even have any commitment to cut its emissions. Mr. Obama can say what he wants, but Congress won't pass it. Most countries have got a commitment to cut their commitments, but it's not nearly big enough to stop us short of the 2 degrees. And you look at those big international conferences and you do not feel inspired. Most of the scientists I've talked to, and actually most of the soldiers I've talked to, think that we are actually going to go past the point where you would normally get runaway warming. And here we have to do something slightly scientific, which is stop saying 2 degrees and talk about the actual amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that would give you 2 degrees. And that is 450 parts per million. We are now at 390 parts per million, so we aren't that far away. And 450 gives you 2 degrees. There is, by the way, signed up to over the last year, virtual consensus globally. Almost all the governments on the planet have committed to keeping us under 2 degrees higher average global temperature. The U.S. has accepted it, Russians, Chinese, everybody. If you're going to go through 450 parts per million, are you doomed to hit the 2 degrees that would normally give you, and into runaway and good night nurse, you know? And the answer is not necessarily, because there are ways that you could actually hold the heat down even if the parts per million go past 450. Intervene artificially in the climate system to hold the heat down by reducing the amount of sunlight that reaches the planet's surface, and so you win yourself some more time to deal with your emissions and may take you another generation, but in the meantime, we don't get runaway warming, because if you don't go through 2 degrees, the permafrost doesn't melt, the oceans don't warm, these natural processes don't kick in and add to the warming, the ones that you can't turn off. So, you know, can we somehow divorce that 2 degree target, which we must not pass, from the 450 parts per million that we probably are going to pass through? The answer is geoengineering. Geoengineering is ways of uncoupling 2 degrees you mustn't cross from 450 parts per million you probably will cross, simply by holding the temperature down. And it's absolutely taboo for scientists to talk about geoengineering, even 2 or 3 years ago. You could lose all your status in the scientific community. Nobody did talk to you. People had nervous breakdowns from the flack they got when they opened their mouths on this issue, because the scientists reckon, and you can't really say that they were completely off base there, that if you tell the public there are ways to hold the heat down, the public, of course, being simple-minded darlings, will get the wrong end of the stick and go, oh, well, look, why don't we just hold the heat down and skip all this hard business of cutting our emissions? And the answer is no. To do that by geoengineering. Now the scientists are so scared that they're talking about it in public. The one that actually has got the most traction is an idea put out by a guy called Paul Crutzen. He got the Nobel Prize for his work on the ozone hole. And he said, look, we're going to go through 450 parts per million. We mustn't go through 2 degrees. How do we separate these things? I propose that we copy what big volcanoes do, because when a big volcano explodes, it will push a lot of gas up into the stratosphere. And the gas that the volcanoes tend to put out in huge quantities is sulfur dioxide, which, when it gets up there in the sunlight with, you know, little droplets of water around, combines with them to form tiny droplets of sulfuric acid, which will reflect sunlight. They do reflect enough sunlight after a big volcano blows to cut the amount of sunlight reaching the surface and lower the temperature. The last big volcano that blew was the Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. And for 2 years after that, we had an average global temperature 0.5 degrees Celsius, almost 1 degree Fahrenheit lower, thanks to the sulfuric acid in the stratosphere. There are still some questions. You wouldn't want to do this globally right now. You'd want to do small tests to make sure that is not a really ugly side effect you haven't thought of.
Wouldn't it be far more feasible and less expensive to actually build these wind turbines all over windy areas and set up the...
Of course it would.
I mean,
you're absolutely right. But do you really think it's going to happen? And if not, where's your fallback position?
Let's think about this for a moment just pragmatically. Because if the financial end of it, because that seems to be the argument against developing the infrastructures and the capacities. And so when we look at it and we go, geez, it just seems like these geoengineering ideas really pale in comparison to doing the very pragmatic things.
They'll happen eventually, but we're going to come up a day late and a dollar short, as human beings often do when faced with a big problem. We'll get there in the end, but the end will be a bit too late. Nobody plans to geoengineer until we're there. But, you know, if it is 2030 and we're at 450 parts per million and it is absolutely clear, though we've moved over a lot to renewables, that we're going to hit 500 parts per million before we get the thing stopped, what do you do? You know, and the answer is you geoengineer, because that's the last option you've got left. And if we do the miracle, I think it's a political miracle. It's not. I mean, you could do this. It's not even very hard or very expensive, but the politics is a killer. And if you get the politics right and you get all those renewables built and you're not burning fossil fuels anymore, nobody is going to want to geoengineer. But I look at the world as it is and I say to myself, this probably isn't going to happen in time. And this is the sort of answer I also get back from the scientists and the soldiers, all of whom want it to happen in time.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the climate wars, the scenarios we are facing, and our options as a humanity. Stay tuned. Look at a couple of things that you mentioned in this book. One is we look at the actual issue of climate change and the potential solutions and the very emotional responses that happen, especially from conservatives, for example, when you talk about regulation. And you cited this sociologist, Donald Brahman. Can you talk a little bit about his findings and how we might apply that?
I thought it was very interesting. He's a professor at George Washington University. What he did was he got a number of people who were self-described as conservatives, and when you sort of gave them a couple of questionnaires to answer, they clearly came up, you know, all nines for conservative. And he gave half of them a description of the problem of climate change and a proposed solution which involved a great deal of government intervention and regulation and even compulsion. And, of course, they hated it. And furthermore, they didn't believe that climate change was a problem. This is not necessary. Government shouldn't be doing this. It's not a problem anyway. And if it is a problem, it's a natural problem not caused by us. This is nonsense. You give the other group of conservatives the same description of what the climate problem is, but now you offer them instead a set of solutions that involve unleashing private enterprise, investing in nuclear power, a full-on technological solution, which is largely in private hands. And they love it. And not only do they love it, but now they believe the climate science. It folds into how they think the world should work. He did this with liberals, too, and they were just as predictable.
What would be interesting then, and you mentioned also in your book that there are all of these enterprises exploring various types of alternatives, even ExxonMobil, which was the chief campaigner against the science, against climate science. And now you say they're pouring money into these new potential technologies like algae biofuel for airlines.
Oh, yeah. $600 million over 5 years. Which is, you know, serious money even for ExxonMobil, more than $500 million, to develop a source of liquid fuel that you could use in cars, use in aircraft, so on, which is carbon neutral. When you burn it, sure, it puts carbon in the air, but it's only the carbon you took out of the air when you grew the plants that you take the fuel from. And the plant in question is actually pond scum. It's algae. The beauty of this compared to, you know, like growing corn, which is now taking up about a quarter of the good agricultural land in the United States, not to feed people or even to feed animals, but to provide us with ethanol, which is a crazy use of agricultural land. If you're doing it with algae, well, you don't need to use land, actually. I mean, agricultural land, you know, open ponds will do it, or you can grow the stuff in vats. Your only inputs are sunlight and carbon dioxide. The water you use can be wastewater or even salt water, so you're not using valuable agricultural water. And when you've grown this stuff, and it'll double its mass every 24 hours, you crush it. And out of the algae, depending on which strain you're using, you get somewhere between one-third and two-thirds of the mass is actually oil. And it's, you know, it's a vegetable oil, but if you can push it through an ordinary refinery and crack it, and you get gas off the top, diesel in the middle, bunker at the bottom, all of which will go through the existing distribution systems and will run existing engines. You don't have to change the whole system. So that's the kind of solution ExxonMobil is working on. A lot of other people are too. They finally realized that they're not oil companies, they're energy companies. And we're not going to give up our cars, but we do have to stop burning fossil fuel in them. So if you can get ahead of the pack and come up with a fuel that'll run these cars and is carbon neutral, you just assured yourself two generations of market leadership.
So when you point out that the largest funder of the denial campaign, ExxonMobil, is actually trying to develop this new technology, and in the same breath, you also wrote about these other consortiums, for example, Desertec, which is designed a plan to power 15% of Europe through solar power in the desert. And then there are the efforts for geothermal and the wind. I mean, does that give you any hope that we aren't going to have to geoengineer and that we aren't going to have to build new nuclear power plants?
a little bit, but I mean, the task is immense and the timelines aren't good. I mean, we wasted the last decade. It'd be a lot more optimistic if we'd been working away at this over the last decade, but by and large, we weren't, although we understood by then what the problem was. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I think we'll get away with this. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, I don't.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about, for example, Desertec and these kinds of things that are being developed?
Well, this is a proposal which is actually, it's more than a proposal. There's now a contract signed, a whole consortium of really big European energy companies who are making a deal with the countries of North Africa, Algeria, Tunisia, so on. The idea is, you know, they've got 98% of their territory's desert. And it's the Sahara Desert, which is a fairly sunny place, as they say. So why don't you use that vast expanse of desert with very energetic sunshine, put in your solar arrays, you know, the sort of the little cells that collect the electricity from sunlight, and then there's not much market for it in Algeria, which doesn't have a huge power demand, but run a cable under the Mediterranean Sea and plug it in at the other end to the European energy grid. Now you're cooking, because there's a market. And why would the Algerians do this? Because they depend on selling oil now, but they know, A, that oil is going to become less and less popular, and if we get ahead of the problem, a lot of it will remain in the ground forever because we stop burning it, and even if not, they're going to run out of it. So here's an export that will go on giving into the generation after generation long-term future. Why wouldn't they do that? And in fact, they'd love to do it. So, I mean, there are this kind of these deals to be made, and people can make money at it. You know, the conservatives can rest easy. Private enterprise will do lots of this. In fact, most of it. But here's the thing. Why am I a pessimist about us getting all the way to there in time? It's this. We need a global deal in order to get this happening, because if any country starts investing in a big way in these technologies and spending the money and its trade rivals don't, then it's at a huge disadvantage. We are spending the money to fix the atmosphere for everybody, but nobody else is carrying their share of the load, and their products cost less than ours because we're spending that extra money. So you need a global deal where everybody puts their shoulder to the wheel, or nobody will. Why can't we make a global deal? Why do they keep meeting every December? Why can't they just say, okay, that's the problem, here's the solution, sign here? And the answer is that there's a real historical problem. And the historical problem is this: 80% of the greenhouse gases that are in the air now of human origin, the excess stuff that's causing the warming, was put there by a very small group of countries, of which the United States is one. You know, it's the old industrial countries, America, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Canada, Russia, Japan. We account for about 1/7 of the world's population. We put 80% of that stuff out there because we started putting it up there 2 centuries ago. We had our industrial revolution. We got rich because we were burning fossil fuels, and we've taken up almost all the space in the atmosphere that is available in terms of dumping extra carbon dioxide in there before you go past 450 parts per million and crash through the 2-degree barrier. So now all these other countries come along, China and India and Brazil and all the rest, who want to industrialize, who are now well on the way to doing it. But if they do it the way we did it, burning fossil fuels, we all go over the cliff together. So make a deal that somehow lets them go on growing their economies, but stops them from growing their emissions, because it's mainly them whose emissions are increasing now.
It would make sense for them to then develop the technology that would take us out of this mess.
Indeed, except they're still relatively poor countries. Right. So somebody's got to pay for that, and it probably isn't them. Actually, when you go to these big conferences, everybody knows what the deal is. I mean, it doesn't get signed, but everybody knows what it would look like if it were made. And it looks like this. The developed countries, because they are largely responsible for the fact that we're so near the edge now, take really big cuts up front. The numbers that were being kicked around 2 years ago in Copenhagen, 40% cuts in 10 years in our emissions, which is a big bite. Wouldn't be cheap. Doable. You wouldn't have to mobilize like we did in the Second World War, but you definitely feel the pain. We take 40% cuts in 10 years. That sort of slows down the process and gives a little breathing space, and then we can do it a little bit less vigorously in the next decade, so we have to keep doing it. The developing countries don't take cuts. They cap their emissions where they are now. Don't expect them to take cuts. They're still poor. We're rich. We've been burning this stuff for 200 years. They've been burning it for 20. They still do per capita maybe a quarter of what we do per capita in terms of emissions. You mustn't expect them to take cuts. The most you can ask them is to cap their emissions where they are now. We'll take the cuts. And if they cap their emissions, that means they can't put any more fossil fuel sources of power in. They can't put any more coal-fired plants in. You know, their vehicles have to be fueled by something that isn't gasoline. Who pays the difference between the cheap and dirty coal-fired plant that China puts up every week now and the solar array, the wind farm, the nuclear plant, whatever it is that they put up instead once they sign that deal and agree not to increase their emissions? And the answer is we do. That's the deal. And it is fair, but it looks very lopsided. I mean, if any Western leader came home having signed that and said to the gathered nation, we've saved the planet, here's the deal, we're going to cut our emissions by 40%, the developing countries won't raise their emissions anymore, they're going to cap them, oh, and we're going to be shipping $100 billion collectively a year to them so that they can go on growing their economies without growing their emissions, you wouldn't survive a week in office. That's why the deal doesn't get done. It will get done eventually. We do have an ability to learn, but it may be a bit late. And that's why on Thursdays, I'm a pessimist.
Well, Gwen Dyer, author of Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, Maria.